Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. Our guest is Jason Leopold. He joins us for the second time this month to talk about his April stories in truthout.org and the declassification of new State Department documents. We will also be taking a look at Leopold's new book, News Junkie, available by advanced order from jasonleopold.com or amazon.com. He will be talking about the book at the Harvard Co-op at 7 p.m. in Cambridge on Tuesday, May 9th. On April 17th, Jason Leopold's report in truthout.org was titled State Department Memo, 16 Words Were False. It centers on new information about what the president knew before including his famous 16 words about Iraq trying to obtain nuclear materials from Niger in his 2003 State of the Union address. He writes, quote, "The revelation of the warning from the closely guarded State Department memo is the first piece of hard evidence and the strongest to date that the Bush administration manipulated and ignored intelligence information in their zeal to win public support for invading Iraq." In Truth Out on April 18th, Jonathan Steele and Julian Borger wrote a piece titled U.S. Refuses to Discuss Iran's Nuclear Plans in Face-to-Face Talks on Iraq. They say, quote, "Although the U.S. is resisting pressure to deal with Iran's nuclear ambitions through direct talks with Tehran rather than sanctions or military strikes, it still intends to meet senior Iranian officials for discussions on Iraq, at which it will demand an end to Iranian meddling," according to Zalmay Khalizade, the U.S. ambassador in Baghdad. End quote. The war on words over Iran's nuclear research, they say is for power, has come to be very reminiscent of the war on words over Iraq's phantom nuclear weapons program. And as we continue to hear reports on attempts to initiate Security Council sanctions or the IAEA's take that Iran is still years away from having a weapon, one can't help but feel a sense of irony accompanied by a fear that we are moving in dangerous circles, that military action towards Iran is starting in much the same way that the failed Iraq war policies began. Jason Leopold, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me, Dori.
There is breaking news about a report that further implicates the White House in terms of Iraq war policy. Why don't you talk about your take on this breaking story?
Yeah, well, basically what it is a State Department memo that was drafted in June 2003 in which it's actually connected to the Valerie Plame CIA leak. What the memo actually says, or I should back up a bit, it's the memo was prepared by the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research. It was prepared in response to questions that Scooter Libby posed in June 2003 about former Ambassador Joe Wilson's trip to Niger to investigate allegations that Iraq was trying to obtain uranium. In this memo, what's fascinating about it is not so much what it says about Joe Wilson, but what the State Department actually said in response to the allegations that Iraq was, you know, supposedly trying to obtain uranium from Niger. And what that says is that, on January 12, 2003, you know, and I'll end the quote there and paraphrase, the State Department alerted the CIA that the allegations that Iraq trying to obtain uranium from Niger was based on forged documents. Now, that was 16 days before President Bush's State of the Union address. This memo is the first piece of hard evidence and the strongest to date that shows that the White House, the Bush administration, manipulated and ignored intelligence in their enthusiasm, you know, to preempt its strike. It's something that we had not known before in terms of the exact date. There have been reports, many reports over the past 3 years that said the White House was warned. But this is the first time that we have a concrete date. And the fact that it came 16 days before the State of the Union address, you know, really, in my opinion, basically implicates the White House in ignoring the intelligence. So while it is connected to the Plame investigation, this is quite explosive.
Now, tell listeners where they can learn more about this story, Jason Leopold.
Actually, the story is posted. The story and the memo itself, we posted a copy of the memo on truthout.org, which is where I write, or who I write for these days. And, you know, the memo is about 6 pages. And when I read it, I have to say that it blew my mind in terms of, like, wow, you know, how can the White House, how can the Bush administration actually say that they did not see this? I mean, it's clear that this, you know, that the State Department and the CIA were both in the know and were, you know, really trying to, you know, do their best to warn, you know, the White House that don't use this, because it seems as if they were trying to warn them, because the White House kept saying, we're going to use it. Actually, also what it says in the memo is that the warnings that came on January 12th is the reason that Colin Powell did not bring up the uranium allegations when he went before the United Nations Security Council just 1 week after the State of the Union. But the memo is posted there. I think it's a really great read, and it will go down in history as just another example of how the Bush administration manipulated intelligence to win support for the war.
And we have to think back over everything that was said in defense of that statement about what Iraq had. And even recently we've heard stories about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, just kind of really pounding this lie into the dust, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, that's the key word there is lie. You know, before it was, when I say before, maybe 3 years ago, maybe sometime earlier, it was maybe thought of as, let's give the White House maybe the benefit of the doubt. At this point, there's no doubt that this was a lie. I mean, I can't believe that the executive branch, the vice president's office, you know, the secretary of state, the national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice at the time, did not know about this. There is just no way. The fact is that they knew, but they didn't care. And they went and they, you know, peddled this lie in order to, win support from Congress, because Congress certainly wasn't aware of it either.
Now, let's talk about Richard Armitage, who received this memo, his role and also his responsibility now that we know that he had this information.
Yeah, now there's two things here. The memo that I have posted, along with the story, is dated June 10th, 2003. Scooter Libby requested Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Mark Grossman asked him to obtain information about Joe Wilson's trip. The same memo, dated July 7th, 2003, was sent to Richard Armitage. It came one day after Joe Wilson's op-ed in the New York Times, in which he disclosed that he was the special envoy who traveled to Niger to investigate these allegations and found it to be baseless. Once that op-ed appeared, Colin Powell had asked for some more information. That's when he asked his deputy, Richard Armitage, to get the information. So this State Department memo, from what we're told, was taken out of the safe. It was classified at the time, taken out of the safe, you know, maybe some minor changes, but a new date added onto it. So in essence, it's really the same memo, just, a different date. And Richard Armitage, I should, you know, go a step further and say that there's been some speculation that he is one of the senior administration officials who disclosed Valerie Plame's CIA status and identity to Bob Woodward and or Robert Novak. I have to say that I'm not convinced, nor do I believe that he was the one who did that, even in passing, even, you know, just in a casual way, simply because he just didn't appear to be in the know at the time.
Richard Armitage and others have done a lot of talking about the war and about these kinds of events since that time in 2003 when he was learning about all of this behind the scenes. And he has not exactly come forward with his responsibility to tell the American people exactly what happened.
No, that's absolutely true. And I mean, Colin Powell has actually said a mouthful last week when he spoke to a columnist at the San Francisco Chronicle, saying that he never believed the Niger allegations. It was not something that he was ever convinced about. And it's, you know, in my opinion, too late to sort of come clean. But certainly Armitage and Lawrence Wilkerson and many senior officials from the State Department, as well as even George Tenet of the CIA, haven't really given the full accounting of what took place. Now, speaking of George Tenet, I actually contacted his spokeswoman earlier this week, because this declassified State Department memo that was released on Monday says that, the State Department let the CIA know. He was head of the CIA. Now, what I was told was from a spokeswoman is that George Tenet will come clean about how the 16 words, which is the uranium allegations have now been, that's the phrase that is used, is the infamous 16 words ended up in President Bush's State of the Union address. He'll come clean on that, but only in his book. He's writing a book called At the Center of the Storm, which is supposed to be released in late October, early November. And only then will we get the full story. And it seems to be very, disingenuous that people need to pay, $25 to learn the truth.
Now, given the climate that we're in right now, with the U.S. basically talking openly now about a possible attack on Iran and stories coming out about that, and it all being about Iran developing a nuclear weapon.
Right. As Yogi Berra said, it's deja vu all over again. I mean, they certainly have, from what I understand, war plans already drawn up. And while they're publicly talking diplomacy, what they're really doing behind the scenes is they're setting the stage for another preemptive strike, because this is the whole preemptive doctrine that these hawks in the administration, these policy people like Richard Armitage, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, what they have long tried to sell to the American people is a preemptive strike is what you do when a foreign nation poses a threat. So there's no doubt that there are war plans drawn up right now. I think Congress needs to immediately, get to the bottom of this and call for an investigation, because we're in a situation where, we're going to now possibly be fighting two wars at once.
And talk about the role of the IAEA and the Security Council. What might they do in response to these new revelations?
That's actually very interesting. The IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, is not a body that is well-respected by the White House, particularly Dick Cheney. In fact, in the story that I had written yesterday regarding this State Department memo, one of the things that it says in there is that the State Department had been in communication with the IAEA, along with other nuclear bodies that are responsible for checking out the enrichment of uranium, etc. And, they all came to the same conclusion. But Dick Cheney, on Meet the Press in March 2003, when Mohammed El-Baradei, who was the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, when he exposed these Niger documents as forgeries, Dick Cheney said, frankly, I think Mr. El-Baradei is wrong. I don't see any reason why they should be right now when they were so wrong about Saddam Hussein in the past. This is not a White House that respects others. They don't have any respect for the UN Security Council. They don't have respect for people on the ground that are charged with actually investigating this material. It simply comes down to the fact that they'll let these people do what they have to do, file the reports they have to file, but at the end of the day, the White House is going to do, or I should say this administration is going to do what they want to do, and they will try to sell the American people on it. The difference now, hopefully, will be that we won't buy it.
Jason, you have written a lot about Patrick Fitzgerald, and the blogosphere is full of comments and discussions about your various stories. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention a few of the questions that bloggers I know have for you. And one, this is about the Plame affair, Scooter Libby, the president and vice president. We have been getting a very sanitized version of the skimming, really, of these facts. And you've been putting them together. But talk about the fact that there are big missing pieces, like the White House Iraq group, or, for example, the role of people like Larry Franklin or the Israel lobby AIPAC, things like that.
Sure.
Just talk about those other big pieces and how they might be revealed to the American people.
Well, I have written about the White House Iraq group and their involvement in this. And the White House Iraq group was a body that was put together by Andrew Card, the former chief of staff to President Bush. And the members included Condoleezza Rice and Karl Rove and Stephen Hadley, Scooter Libby. And basically what their job was is to market and sell the Iraq war to the American people. There were records that were actually subpoenaed by Patrick Fitzgerald to see what role this group of people played in the campaign to discredit Joe Wilson, whether this group in and of itself was responsible for the plane leak. Now, the reason for that is to see if there's any evidence to file charges to see if there was a conspiracy. If you have a group like this working together, that would suggest that there was a conspiracy, which would be a huge crime, or I should say, you know, a big charge. You know, there is a lot of evidence, and I've written extensively about the fact that the people that were involved in the campaign to discredit Joe Wilson, and as well as the Valerie Plame leak, were all members of the White House Iraq group. And I have not taken up the Larry Franklin AIPAC angle yet, simply because my plate is full with what's in front of me, just with the senior folks in the administration. And, you know, I was hoping to leave that to others, at least at this point, in terms of fleshing that part out. But there certainly is a lot of tentacles to this story. And I do understand that the blogosphere, which, let's face it, you know, the blogosphere certainly has kept this story alive. And, you know, it's funny that you mentioned some of the comments that have come, because I have certainly taken quite a beating from, you know, even the liberal blogosphere because of some of the stories I wrote, which have anonymous sources in them. And, you know, to go a step further, because of my past, which I've written about in my, you know, obviously in my book, News Junkie, you know, I've been trying to rebuild my credibility with people for 3 years now, since that episode took place with Salon, which, you know, I have since proven, or I should say the evidence has since shown, that I was actually right all along. I just made some missteps along the way. But I think the blogosphere has a very good handle on this story. And they certainly have shown that, you know, citizen journalism, if you will, is a really important part of this whole investigation, because, you know, you have people who work in various different places or industries who actually have the time to analyze these documents and who have collected the evidence and have put together their own take on this. And it actually is surprising because it's very strong. I think that that's what's, to me, totally amazing about the blogosphere, is how good of a handle they have on this story and how strong their arguments are and on where this story is going. And in fact, there's a website called, or a blog called The Left Coaster, and one of the bloggers there has done an amazing job of putting together, you know, the background on the Niger documents, and it's just unbelievable. It's groundbreaking. It's being done well before the mainstream media has taken it on.
I can't help but think of your book now, because you talk about what happened when, as an editor, you were looking at the Enron story in intense competition about that story. And you actually went to the blogs to look for a new take. You had broken a few stories about Enron.
Right.
What did you actually talk about that just briefly, the story you actually discovered by going online?
Yeah, actually, at the time, there were, you know, blogs were in their infancy, and many of the things that were discussed in just simply chat rooms, websites that were created specifically to discuss issues like Enron. And I went on there to poke around, because these are people who had, you know, worked at Enron, that were all getting together to, you know, in cyberspace to, you know, discuss what was happening. And some of the things that were discussed were, you know, do you remember that time that we went downstairs to the trading floor and had to pose as secretaries? You know, it was a great place for tips, because it was people speaking in the open. It was people speaking as if you were in someone's living room, and it was like being a fly on the wall.
We're talking with Jason Leopold, author of News Junkie, available through Amazon.com by advanced order. Jason Leopold broke some of the first stories about Enron and the company's manipulation of the energy market, then a fake trading floor set up by Enron, as well as stories about former Secretary of the Army Thomas White, who resigned in scandal. I asked him to talk about the way members of the growing alternative press continue to try to compensate for the decline in America's media, though presently they cannot hope to replace it.
You know, there is definitely an attitude that the story like I ran is important. If you have somebody who may not be well known that is reporting something like this, say 6 months ago, the attitude is, well, if it's really true, if it's truly important, it would be on the front page of the Washington Post. Therefore, let's not lend any credibility toward it, or let's not give it any credibility. Let's not give these stories any credibility. I'm actually experiencing that right now with some of my stories on the CIA leak, that, well, you know, Jason doesn't write for the New York Times or the Washington Post. So really, how credible is he? Sure, there have been, you know, there are questions about some of a report that I did 4 years ago, which is, you know, obviously getting a lot of play. And I'm talking about the Thomas White story that I had written for Salon. But, you know, you don't get the attention or the story does not get any real play unless it is in the New York Times or the Washington Post or on CNN. You know, we're sort of a people that want an independent media, want some real reporting, and when someone does it, it's actually, you know, they try to discredit it.
Just talk about Thomas White, the government official who resigned. Talk about the story where you were doubted in what you were saying, but it did turn out to be true.
I go into great detail about that in my book, and, you know, I was brutally honest in my book, and I was certainly, if anything, did not portray myself in a very positive light. I'm basically here to say that the truth is ugly. And I spent a year investigating Thomas White. He was tapped in May 2001 as a Secretary of the Army, and he was the former Vice President of Enron Energy Services. Enron Energy Services was Enron's retail outfit, which has come to play a major role in the bankruptcy of Enron. And I had written a story that said Thomas White knew that this unit that he was running was basically a house of cards. I had obtained about 100 pages of documents showing that Thomas White, a guy who was tapped by the Bush administration to be the Secretary of the Army, was not involved in fraudulent activities, but knew that the unit he ran was basically a house of cards. And here he was leading the Army and responsible for an $86 billion budget. So there was an email that I had obtained that said, close a bigger deal, hide the loss before the first quarter. And that email was in response to one of his underlings saying, we've got a problem. We're going to show a loss in the next quarter. What should we do? One of these contracts is hemorrhaging cash. As soon as I put this story out, which was in August 2002, it didn't make a sound. It didn't make a sound until Paul Krugman picked it up in the New York Times and wrote about it. As soon as Paul Krugman picked it up, you know, I was immediately turned into the story. In fact, it's interesting. Bob Novak, who played the essential role in the, you know, he was the first one to print Valerie Plame's identity, went on CNN and called me the outrage of the week. And he actually made up a story out of whole cloth saying that he tried to contact me and that I ignored his calls and never called him back regarding Thomas White. Basically, to make a long story short, I was turned into the story. There were allegations that I plagiarized a Financial Times piece, when in fact I had credited the Financial Times. I may not have provided them with enough credit, but I actually credited them. And then there was pressure that came on Salon. This was at a time when reporters were not questioning the White House, were not going after the White House. This was when everybody was being their lapdog, everyone in the media. If you go back and look at it, I think the evidence would actually prove that to be true. So here I was going after the White House. That was the intent of my story, to show that, hey, wait a minute, we got a guy here running the Army, and he knew about the fraud going on in Enron. Somebody should hold this person responsible. So there was pressure that came onto Salon, and of course they dispute it. They dispute this entirely and will say something different. And the story was pulled, and I was turned into the story. And that was actually the genesis, for writing this book. Because I really wanted to, first of all, give people an accurate look at what goes on behind the scenes of the cutthroat world of investigative journalism, at the same time showing how a flawed person like myself, who has shortcomings, who has a past, really tried to do good work, and how the past informed my professional life.
Well, I just wonder, we have so many extreme difficulties and reflected in these amazing news stories about the environment or Enron or the war. Do you ever find yourself sort of using these stories as a way to explain some of what you're feeling about yourself and about the world? I mean, it did take
you... Yeah, actually, that's a good question. You know, it's actually what is happening. What is happening, you know, in the world that actually makes me so passionate about writing these stories, so passionate about getting to the heart and to the truth of what this is, what is actually going on in our country. My stories, the things that I write, are a reflection of how I feel personally. I try my best to be objective, but let's face it, I don't write for the LA Times or the Washington Post. I write for publications that have a liberal slant. My stories are a reflection of how passionate I am about exposing, you know, what I feel are lies. And even before that, the stories that I wrote when I was working at Dow Jones, it was a way for me, by exposing these people, it was a way for me to purge my own feelings of guilt and shame, to really, you know, empty out how I felt about myself. Because the stories I was covering, they really impacted me, because here I am writing about people who are being accused of crimes, and at the same time, I have been accused of a crime and have pled guilty to one, and I kept that bottled up, and by writing these stories, it actually allowed me to purge my feelings. So in a way, it helped. In some respects, it actually hurt me too, because it you know, it meant that I was, you know, not dealing with my own issues and dealing with it through others. But in the end, I think that it gave me a great look inside of myself, and it's interesting how the things that I write today, it really is a reflection of who I am as an individual.
Sometime perhaps we can have you back to talk about how your book is really a love story about you and your wife.
Yes, I would love that, because it really is. That's one of the underlying themes in there.
Jason Leopold, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dori.
Jason Leopold is former bureau chief of Dow Jones Newswires. He also worked for the LA Times, The Nation, The Wall Street Journal, and The Financial Times. His switch to more progressive, alternative, and independent media outlets finds him currently writing for Utney Reader, Alternet, and Counterpunch. Jason Leopold broke key stories about California's energy crisis and Enron. His recent book, News Junkie, is available by advanced order. Investigative journalist Greg Pallast of the BBC said of this book, "Bravo, and my personal Pulitzer to Jason Leopold. Every journalist in America should read this and then quit, or riot." Jason Leopold will speak at the Harvard Co-op at 7 p.m. in Cambridge, Tuesday, May 9th. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. Talk Nation Radio is produced at WHUS Stores, radio for the people at the University of Connecticut. To listen live, try WHUS.org, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. And for transcripts and discussion, try TalkNation.org or TalkNationRadio.org.